Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
And I mentioned some of you probably had a great weekend, and some of you probably had a crap weekend. I know for a fact yesterday was a really rough day for, among others, Bill Belichick, Tom Brady haters, and the Green Bay Packers. Brutal. I mean, really brutal. Because Tom Brady and his new team are going back to the Super Bowl once again, and, you know, Belichick, the hood, is sitting at home, grumbling and muttering to himself. So over the next 2 weeks, there's going to be a whole lot to say about Brady and the Bucks. So I'm going to actually keep it brief today. But let me say this. I don't care how much you hate this guy. I don't care how lame his social media is. You have to admit, what Brady has done this season is pretty damn impressive. Yes, I know that he handpicked a team that is loaded with weapons on offense and has got a ton of talent on defense. I know that he went to the best spot that he could find. I know that he got his old tight end out of retirement and that he brought in Mr. Big Chest. I know there is more talent on this Bucks team than on this year's Pats team. But still, he's going back to the Super Bowl again. In his first season, with a new team, and a new coach, and a new scheme, and no offseason or preseason to speak of. And if you're being really honest, at times in the first half yesterday, Brady looked younger and fresher and stronger than almost ever before. It was a laser show. Like, I see that, and what that guy was doing in the first half, and I'm swearing off nightshades for the rest of my life. I mean, for the longest of times, I didn't even know what the hell a nightshade was. I see that, and I'm wondering, is this old man still selling his recovery pajamas? And if so, how much do they cost? Hell, I don't even care what they cost. I've got to get me some. Oh, and that $200 coffee book table, too. Give me a couple of those. I'm watching this guy in the first half at 43 on the road in the NFC title game, and I'm thinking, how the hell is that even possible? And then, when he started handing out interceptions like they were avocado ice cream cones, his defense bailed him out time and time again. Which reminds me, you better start giving Todd Bowles some love, some run, because his defense has carried and picked that team up time and time again this year. And yes, even though the refs let both teams play, they sure did come out with a really convenient flag for Tampa when they needed it most. Now, I'm not saying that that was not pass interference by Kevin King on 3rd and 4 with 1:46 to go in the game and the Packers needing a stop to get the ball back. What I am saying is that was not PI for the 58 minutes that came before it. Again, there'll be lots of time to talk about Brady and the Bucks and what they've done. There's a really high risk of hitting Jerome Bettis is from Detroit levels of talk about Brady and the Bucks and the fact that they're playing the Super Bowl at home. We'll get to that. Plenty of time for that. All of that. We have 2 weeks for that.
2 weeks.
But for now, and I hate to do this, Packer fans, but we've got to talk about a couple of moments from yesterday, what they meant to the game and what they might mean to the future of that team. And you know the moments that I'm talking about. The first one came with 34 seconds left in the first half. When Sean Murphy bunting picked off Aaron Rodgers at midfield. Not an ideal outcome given that Green Bay had hoped to get points at the end of the half and then start the ball or start the second half with the ball. But the defense came up with stops on first, second, and third down. Then came fourth down and Tampa Bay's decision not to punt and try to pick up the first down. I mean, not surprising at all if they try, right? It's Bruce Arians. The shock was initially when it looked as if they were going to punt. Of course they were going to go for it. Why would you punt there? Why would you even send the punt team out onto the field in the first place? But then it gets worse for Green Bay. So much worse. Not only did the Bucs go for it, not only did they get the first down, they got this.
Brady shotgun snap, running back block, winds up long pass down the near side, caught for a touchdown! Falling in the end zone, Scotty Miller! The Buccaneers have scored! Brady throwing an arching spiral down the far side, 6 yards deep on the far side of the end zone. 39-yard touchdown pass, Brady!
Well, I was right.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, give him 10 yards and let him kick a field goal. Worst case scenario. Huge, huge mistakes here at the end of the half for the Green Bay Packers.
Westwood won. No risk it, no biscuit. And Brady was shoveling biscuits into his face like they were made of alkalizing vegetables. That throw from Brady was as good as that coverage was horrible. I mean, I'm really not sure what defensive coordinator Mike Pettine was thinking by dialing that up on the final play of the half. What did you think was going to happen there? I'm not going to say it was the worst call ever, but Tony Dungy, of all people, will. Keep in mind, this is Tony Dungy we're talking about. Tony Dungy is not known for slinging lava or delivering straight fire. It's not his deal, but it was after he saw how that half ended. My man was reaching for his phone and thumbing out the following, and I quote, "That may be the worst defensive design I've ever seen with 8 seconds and no timeouts left. Green Bay, I'm not sure how you play inside technique, man-to-man, and not just play zone and protect the sideline and the end zone. Amazing." End of tweet. I mean, damn. You know you've messed up when Tony Dungy is ripping your play call on Twitter and calling it, quote, "the worst defensive design I've ever seen." End of quote. If Tony Dungy is unloading on you, you know you've done something really dumb. If you see a tweet like that from that guy, and you're the guy who just dialed up that play, then you simply shake everybody's hand, you pack up your office, and you beat it. Triple G Greg Williams cannot believe that play call. And neither could Packers head coach Matt LaFleur, who said the following.
Yeah, it was man coverage. Definitely not the right call for the situation. And you can't do stuff like that against a good football team and expect to win.
How about that? Just ran his guy right under the bus. Just ran his dude right under the bus. But then in the second half, LaFleur pushed Pettine aside and said, "Hey, yo, hold my beer." Because with just over 2 minutes left in the game, LaFleur made the call that may very well haunt him for the rest of his career. And it could change the course of that franchise. Fourth and goal from the 8, down by 8. LaFleur elects to kick a field goal instead of trying to tie the game. And I know the offense had stalled out on the previous 3 plays. I know there may have been an opportunity for Aaron Rodgers to scramble on 1 or 2 of those plays. But that fourth down call is going to go down in history. Because you can't make that call. You simply cannot make that call. You cannot elect to give the ball back to Tom Brady and then dare him to run 2 minutes off the clock to get to a Super Bowl. I don't even care that that guy had thrown interceptions on 3 straight drives in the fourth quarter. It's Tom Brady. You give the ball to Brady, you're not getting the ball back. It's a fact. It's just not happening. Especially if you take the ball out of your own MVP's hands. Think about that for a minute. You just ripped the ball from the soon-to-be league MVP and one of the greatest to ever do it in order to give it to the actual greatest to ever do it. The hell is that? Is there anyone anywhere not named Matt LaFleur who thought that Aaron Rodgers was going to touch the ball again after that decision? Hell no. I gotta know, coach. I gotta know, what do you have to say for yourself?
Yeah, anytime it doesn't work out, you always regret it, right? But
right.
It was just the circumstances of having 3 shots and that's coming right away with no yards. And knowing that you not only need the touchdown, but you'd need the 2-point. So the way I was looking at it was we essentially had 4 timeouts with the 2-minute warning. You know, we knew we needed to get a stop. And I thought we were going to have a stop there at the end. But, you know, we got called for the PI. It didn't work out. So I think anytime something doesn't work out, do you regret it? Sure. But we're always going to be process driven here. And the way our defense was battling, the way our defense was playing, it felt like it was the right decision to do. And it just didn't work out.
Sounds like my man regrets that it didn't work out, but not the decision. Look, I know they had 3 timeouts, and I know they had the 2-minute warning. I know they thought they could get a stop, and they nearly did. But you're talking about giving the ball back to Tom Brady with a Super Bowl trip on the line. You know how this goes, or at least you should. And it's not just that he took the field goal over the chance at a TD. It's that he went with his defense over Aaron Rodgers. That's the kind of thing that's going to leave a mark. Got to wonder, right? Like, what do you think Aaron thought of that? What do you think was going through Aaron's mind when that all was playing out?
Aaron, did you agree with the decision to kick it there on fourth down?
Well, I didn't have a decision on that one. Yeah, that wasn't my decision. But I understand the thinking above 2 minutes with all of our timeouts. But yeah, that wasn't my decision.
Quote, it wasn't my decision. It's a hell of a statement, right? And it's completely correct. Not only was the fourth down not his decision, but if he had known that LaFleur was going to kick a field goal, he probably would have been more aggressive on third down. As Aaron said, quote, I thought maybe we were going to have four chances to go, end quote. But he never got that fourth chance. He probably thought it was two down territory. Yeah, I don't know, Matty. Maybe you actually communicate to your Hall of Famer. Maybe you tell him before third down, yo, big dude, this is not two down territory. Punch it in right now, because if you don't, I'm taking the points. But apparently that's not what he did. Rodgers had to be, what the bleep, when he saw Mason Crosby and that field goal team come out. No wonder he was not exactly enthusiastic when discussing his future with the team after the game. Can you believe the guy or blame the guy? He probably had John L. Smith running through his head on repeat.
We should have been in a ball game with fast field goal. The coach had sent him in. We shouldn't have sent him in. That's a dang coaching mistake. The kids are playing their tail off, and the coaches are screwing it up.
I bet he had that thing on a loop in his head. Of course, he was in no mood to discuss his future with the team after that all went down.
A lot of guys' futures that are, you know, uncertain, you know, myself included. That's what's sad about it most. Getting this far, obviously, there's going to be an end to it at some point, whether we make it past this one or not, but just the uncertainty is tough, and the finality of it all.
My man is solemn, understandably so, too. Now what? Now yeah. What? Now what? He was also asked how the team can take the next step.
I don't know. I really don't. There's a lot of unknowns going into this offseason now, and I'm going to have to take some time away for sure and clear my head and just kind of see what's going on with everything. But it's pretty tough right now, especially thinking about the guys that may or may not be here next year. There's always change. That's the only constant in this business.
I'll tell you what, I get that guys are going to be, as Roger said, gutted after a loss like that. But man, that was completely and totally gutting. You can hear it in his voice. So I'm not going to hold him to what he says in that emotional time. In a moment like that, right after the game, I get that. I understand that. But honestly, I never thought that I would say this, but I will. I absolutely understand if this guy wants to leave. He and the team just battled through so much to get to this point. This guy passed for 48 touchdowns and only 5 INTs. He's the league MVP. And even while he was facing the most pressure that he's ever faced in a playoff game, he still threw for nearly 350 yards, 3 TDs, and had only 1 pick. The guy played his ass off. Brady is going to get all the glory and adulation, and understandably so. But Rodgers absolutely was the better player on the field, is the better player right now, and did everything he was supposed to do, and just had another trip to the Super Bowl ripped from him in brutal fashion. And he's got to be wondering if his coach believes in him. And the fact that the team used a first-round pick that might have come in handy yesterday on a quarterback who was holding a clipboard who is going to be his replacement. Man, you see that. You see that, and then you see what happened when Brady went to a new situation. Brady is the one going to a Super Bowl. Aaron Rodgers is going to look at that and think to himself, you know what? I wonder, man. I wonder if I can do that. I wonder if I can do what that guy did. I would hate to see Aaron leave. It would just feel wrong, but I would completely understand if he did. I would love to see this guy start and finish in the same place, but if they're not all in on him, how can you expect him to be all in on them? But know this, he's not done, not even close to it. He just played arguably the greatest football of his career. He might have really played his last down in Green Bay, but that does not mean this guy's done. Not even close. Question is, do the Packers run it back again? And this time, do they do right by him? Because if they're not going to, somebody else might. And then he would owe it to himself to find out who that is. Because he doesn't have to look any further than the guy who he just outplayed, who has exactly what he wants. Another shot at the trophy. Man, I can't imagine seeing Aaron Rodgers in somebody else's gear, but maybe it is time. And not because of anything he said or did. He did his job. He always does. And if Aaron does leave, good luck with that, Jordan Love. I'm not blaming you. You didn't pick yourself. It's not your fault. But good luck following that legend. Yeah, fans adjust pretty easily. I think there's still Favre maniacs out there saying that Brett would have beat the Bucs. Hell, those Favre maniacs think that Brett would have beat the Bucs today at age whatever he is. Maybe on his way out, you can ask Aaron how he handled it. Hey, you want to hear something amazing? Check this out. Discover matches all the cash back that you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year automatically, with no limit on how much you can earn. I mean, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing because of all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of the places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. Discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report. Limitations do apply. Therese Paylor. Therese, what's going on? Welcome back. How are you?
In the box. How's it going? Thanks for having me on again.
Always good to have you on, dude. Thanks so much. Listen, before we get into the Super Bowl matchup and the piece that you've got up right now on Yahoo about Mahomes and Brady, let me start with the NFC Championship game. You've had some time to think on this now. What was your reaction in real time when Matt LaFleur decided to kick that field goal down 8 with just over 2 minutes to go?
I didn't like it then, mainly because you have the MVP and the GOAT is on the other sideline. And it's easy to Monday morning quarterback that thing, and I know a lot of people do that. I typically don't do that, okay? But you ask me, and I'll tell you, I think in that situation, you're at home, you've got the MVP, I'd rather go out on my shield with Aaron Rodgers. I'd rather, and I get it. You're showing faith in your defense, right? But Tampa's offense is very good. And this is Tom Brady just needing to convert the first down or, you know, maintain a drive. He can do that, and I would rather put my fate in Aaron Rodgers' hands than Tom Brady's hands.
We're talking to Therese Paylor. I agree with you, and I agree with you when you say that it's easy to Monday morning quarterback this thing. I would also add to that, it's easy to Sunday afternoon quarterback that thing, because that seemed like a terrible idea then, and it does now. Now, what do you think was going through Aaron Rodgers' mind when he saw Mason Crosby and the kicking team come out?
I'm sure he was upset. I'm sure he wanted to go for it. Like, they could have gotten that. And I will say this, you know, I've analyzed that game. I broke it down. Like, hey, you know, Tampa's rush was for real in this game. Like, I thought their defensive front played really well. So it's not like they played poorly. Yes, Green Bay got some scores, some big plays on them. And I get it. Like, hey, you know, Tampa's defense is good, but I trust Aaron Rodgers in that situation. Let's go for it. Let's try to make it happen. And by the way, if you don't get it, you still got them back up at the 9-yard line, and you still need to get the football back. So, I mean, I get it. But you would have needed to score a touchdown anyway to win the game. So, I think it would have made a lot more sense to let Aaron Rodgers control your fate.
Therese Paylor joining us. All right, so what about fate? What about Aaron Rodgers? Like, if you're Aaron Rodgers and you saw the way that played out and the fact that the team used that first-round pick on a quarterback in 2020, and then you see how things went for Tom Brady in his first year with a new team, if you're Aaron Rodgers, are you looking for an opportunity somewhere else now?
I definitely think it's intriguing because football wisdom generally states that if you take a first-round quarterback, you can sit him the first year. But the second year, he's got to start playing because you got to know what he is by the end of that third year so you can make a decision on the fifth-year option. This is what the Chiefs did with Mahomes in 2017. After Alex Smith had a really strong season, like they traded him. But, sooner rather than later, you want to start seeing what you have in Jordan Love because what if he gets hurt this year? And what if he gets hurt next year? Then all of a sudden, you got to make a decision on that option on a very valuable position on a commodity, a first-round pick, without really knowing what you've got. So that said, knowing that that's how football wisdom goes, if I'm Aaron Rodgers, I'm like, hey, you guys brought him in. Probably got to play him now, okay? Meanwhile, I'm going to California. And I don't think it's a coincidence that that has become a storyline after this game. I did notice in his press conferences over the last few weeks, over the last month or so, he's been very serene in his interviews, not nearly as on edge, which I thought was interesting, and I couldn't really place it until I heard his comments after the game. If I'm the Los Angeles Rams, I am running to the table to get this guy. If I'm the San Francisco 49ers, I am running to the table to get this guy, because both those teams offer a very similar offense to the one he just operated with stunning efficiency to win the MVP. We don't know that he's won it, but we do, right? I would run to do that if I'm San Francisco or if I'm Los Angeles. And, you know, those two quarterbacks they have are fine. Garoppolo more than Goff, for sure. But if I could do that, if I were those teams, that's an upgrade that would make both of them immediate Super Bowl contenders.
No doubt. Therese Paylor is joining us. All right, so let me ask about this. If we switch over to the AFC Championship game, Bills got off to that really good start. They get a field goal, then they followed out with a three and out, then that fumbled punt, which they cash into a touchdown. What do you make of how Kansas City, though, kept Mecole Hardman engaged in the offense after the fumble?
Well, I love it, and it's an indication of why players love Andy Reid, because when you make a mistake, if he trusts you, he'll give you a chance to prove him right. And they called these plays for that guy to get into the mix and get into the swing of things, because they're going to need him, right? Sammy Watkins, I know we've got 2 weeks, we'll see, but like, even if Watkins plays, they're still going to need Mecole Hardman, and he's got a lot of juice, doesn't he, with the ball in his hands? And he's also their primary returner. So, right, Jim? Like, you want this guy in a right mental space. And I thought it was very good. They didn't just hand him the football on the end of round, which was unbelievably designed. I actually tracked this, Jim. The first offensive lineman, it was Fisher and the left guard. I don't think they had to touch anybody until they were 35 yards downfield. That's how well-schemed that was. But it wasn't just that. It was getting him a touchdown catch, too, to help him make up for the fact he gave up a touchdown, basically. So it's a really good indication of like why players feel so much trust in this coaching staff, why they're so comfortable in Kansas City, because they know, you know, if the staff trusts you, they're going to give you every opportunity to make it right.
We're talking to Therese Paylor. Well said. Like, the play design is just a thing of beauty over and over and over again. And the guy has got so much juice. I mean, I have so much respect for the way, not only that they went right back to him, but the way he responded to a big mistake on a big stage. Like, it didn't even happen. And the guy's out there just making plays. What about Patrick Mahomes? I mean, considering this guy was in concussion protocol last week and he's dealing with a toe injury, how did he look to you yesterday?
Look, as Eric Bieniemy would say, you know, Pat looked like Pat. I kept a close eye on this, right, throughout the course of the game. And multiple times as I was taking my notes and reviewing this game, I'm like, Mahomes' elusiveness. He was avoiding the rush. And some of it was on straight four-man pressures. Some of it was on blitz. They didn't really start trying to heat him up into the second half, which I understand. I actually don't have an issue with the Bills' defensive strategy. Like, I think Leslie Frazier did a good job. It's just that Mahomes looked like Mahomes despite the toe, despite the head neck injury, right? Like, Mahomes was incredible. He repeatedly evaded pressure. He repeatedly threw strikes to make them pay. And I just don't know what you're supposed to do if you're a defense. Actually, I do know. You know, you pray, you hope that they don't execute well. But you also, honestly, you know, you do what the Bills did. And, like, you're playing a lot of soft zone. You're playing a lot of zone coverage, and you're rushing four, and you know they're going to light you up between the 20s, but you hope that you can out-execute them in the red zone and force some field goals. Like, that plan is sound, but the problem is the Chiefs are going to score 31 points. You got to score 35 to beat these guys. Like, you just have to. And to that degree, the failure of the game was kind of on the Buffs, on the Bills' offense, because Steve Spagnuolo was in his bag, Jim. 4 sacks, 10 quarterback hurries. Josh Allen, a guy who, trust me, had shown the ability to really handle the blitz. He was not a guy over the last 3 or 4 months of the season that you really wanted to blitz. And Spagnuolo didn't care. He dialed it up from everywhere, second level, third level. And Josh handled it okay, but he didn't handle it well enough to put the amount of points on the board that they needed. And I still really like Josh Allen. I think he's going to be a great player. I think he is a great player. I think he's going to win MVP one day. But that's going to have to be a lesson for these guys that if you're going to beat Kansas City with the guy they've got over there, the truly elite, in his prime, peak of his powers quarterback, your guy has to execute that way too, and he needs help. Way too many drops by the Bills as well.
Yeah, he does need help. They're going to need some more weapons, but I trusted the organization and the guys calling the shots, Brandon Bean, Sean McDermott, they're going to get him the help he needs. But you're right. I mean, they got to go to school on that. And the other thing is, what's really scary about Kansas City, you know what you're going to get offensively, but defensively, when they show up the way they did and they make things difficult on the quarterback the way they did, they're almost impossible to beat. Now, you look ahead a couple of weeks, you've got Patrick Mahomes and Tom Brady in the Super Bowl, or as you've billed it, Brady, Mahomes 5, winner takes all. Lay that out for me. What do you mean by that?
Okay. So we know that Tom Brady is the GOAT, right? Like all these Super Bowls he's been to, all these conference championships games, 6 rings. But I basically call it a delayed legacy game, whereas in 20 years, we might look at this as the tiebreaker. We might look at this game as the tiebreaker between who was the greatest quarterback of all times, Mahomes or Brady. And I know there's a big difference in age here, so it's not like, you know, Ali Liston. It's not like these guys in their absolute prime, Frazier Ali. It's not like that, right? But it is still a kind of a baton passing game in a sense. So put it this way. If Patrick Mahomes wins this game, he'll have 2 Super Bowls to Brady 6. Let's say Mahomes plays 10 to 15 more years, which I think he will because he really loves football, right? I'd seem pretty good that he might be able to get 4 in 15 years with how good he is and how – at least there's a chance of it, right, with how good he is and the organization around him. Now, what happens, though, if Tom Brady wins his 7th and keeps Mahomes from getting 1 here? Now, Mahomes has to get 6 in those 10 to 15 years. And look, Mahomes is so great, you can't say it can't happen, but it makes the task harder. So in a lot of ways, I feel like this is like a legacy tipping point game, even though we won't know the results of it for a couple decades. Right? So that's why I'm laying it out that way. Plus, there's one more really awesome thing about it. I think Brady saw Mahomes coming. That's why in the AFC Championship game 2 years ago, he sought him out in the locker room to kind of co-sign on him. I thought that was a big deal. And this was awesome, too. This is their 5th matchup. It's 2-2, man. And this might be the last time Brady and Mahomes face each other. Brady's 43 years old. The Chiefs and Bucks aren't scheduled to face each other next year. This might be it. So on so many different levels, this is a great game for football, for football historians, and for even casual fans, because everybody can grasp the enormity of this game. And one more thing, Jim, I know I'm rambling, but I'm excited. One more thing, the Chiefs are going for history too, because when you win back-to-back titles, that puts you in a completely different stratosphere than other Super Bowl champions. Think of the America's Game NFL Films documentary, right? Well, the last 2 Super Bowl champions who went back-to-back, it's no coincidence that those were the highest ranked of those dynasties. So I'm talking about the 04 Patriots were the highest ranked America's Game team. I think they were 12th or something. And the 98 Broncos were the highest ranked America's Game team, higher than their 97 champion. And here's one other thing. Think about the 96 Packers. Right? They won the Super Bowl, one of the greater teams we don't talk about anymore. I think their legacy was hurt just a touch by losing to the Broncos in 97 and not repeating. And by the way, the 04 Patriots and the 1998 Broncos, guess what their record was? 14-2, just like this Chiefs team. They got a chance to go for history here, and it's going to be awesome to see if they can do it.
Bills Mafia, I have been here for the last few weeks. And I've started almost every single Monday for the last few weeks by asking you, how you living? So let me ask you it again for the final time this season. How are you living? I've got a pretty good feeling as to how that is. I mean, on the one hand, pretty damn well, right? Pretty damn well given the season that your team just had. But not as well as you had been given the season you thought your team was still going to have. Like, I've got a feeling, knowing you the way I know you, Mafia, that you're proud of your team, but you are pretty crushed to get that close and not get over. I understand that. That is the ultimate blast to the package. And you probably won't like the analogy. I set this up earlier, but let me mention this one more time. I had a similar feeling this weekend when Jungle Racing had a horse. along with L&J Foxwoods, Cruel Intention. We got beat at the wire. Just hear me out. I know you already heard that. But I felt like our horse won that race. And then there was a photo finish. Then we got back word that we did not win the race. So I felt like the horse that beat us strolled over to the winner's circle, looked me up and down, and then kicked me in the junk. I mean, even at the wire, we had won that race. I knew we had. Just like you probably allowed yourself to think that you had won your race when you jumped on the Chiefs to start that game. Because the start of that game in KC could not have gone any better. Field goal on the opening drive. Then a three and out from your defense. And then this, when you had to punt on the second possession.
High in the air. Hardman ranges over to his right. Oh, he loses the football! Scooped up inside the five and diving into the end zone. They're going to rule him down at the two. What a play on special teams working downfield. And it's Tywan Jones. Johnny on the spot for Buffalo. And a huge mistake by Hardman.
Yeah, it's a flat muff.
That was a flat muff. Westwood won. Even Elk knew that was a flat muff. If you're going to beat KC in KC, you need moments like that. You're going to need a break or two to go your way. You're going to need to capitalize on a break like that. And that's exactly what Buffalo did, because one play later, they did this.
Shotgun Allen, fake the handoff, flip to the left. It's caught out there, angling in. Touchdown, Dawson Knox! A catch and run for the score. Buffalo takes advantage of the Kansas City mistake, and the Bills put points on the board.
So Buffalo misses the point after, but they were up 9-0 on the road against the defending Super Bowl champs. They were rolling. Everything was going their way. And Patrick Mahomes looked a little bit shaky early on. He looked like that toe was bothering him. The defense was making plays. And for a moment, Kansas City, I guess I should have known better. We all should have known better. But for a moment, they actually looked a little rattled. And then that moment was gone because Kansas City rattled off three unanswered TDs from down 9-0 to up 21-9 in a heartbeat because the Chiefs, because that's what Kansas City does to you. You think you've got them. You think they're having a bad game. You think you're finally going to break through and finish them. And then suddenly they're just gone, especially in the playoffs. Ask the Texans from last year. Ask the Titans. Ask the 49ers in the Super Bowl. If you're losing, you're losing. If you're tied, you're losing. And even when you're winning, you're losing. Because they're that explosive. They're that fast. They're that dominant. They're that well coached. They're that well schemed. They're the exception to the rule. The rule being that you can't just throw the switch in professional sports. And generally, you can't, but the Chiefs can, and they do, pretty much whenever the hell they want. So I've said it before, and I'll say it again. They're kind of like the Golden State Warriors back in the day. You think you're in a game with them. You think you might even have a look at beating them, and then they hit you with this flurry on offense and defense, and suddenly you're sucking wind, and you're sucking their exhaust. 14-play TD drive that ended with this Mecole Hardman TD.
Mahomes will throw it to that left side. Catch made, acceleration, into the end zone. Touchdown, Mecole Hardman. The Chiefs strike back.
A little redemption for Mecole Hardman after the big muffed punt.
Then a quick stop on defense, followed by this Hardman play to start off the next drive. Like, I'm not sure I've ever seen somebody bounce back from a nearly catastrophic mistake on a really big stage the way Hardman did last night. That was impressive. Impressive by him and by the coaching staff to stay with him, because that 50-yard play that he made set up this.
They give it off. Inside handoff goes to Darrell Williams. Trucks the defender. Diving touchdown! Kansas City, like an 18-wheeler, busting through a bunch of hay bales. It is Darrell Williams on a 6-yard touchdown run.
That's exactly what that was like. And then that was followed by a three and out, and then this.
In the shotgun, Edwards-Helaire. Started right, now left. Edwards-Helaire diving right side. Touchdown! Non-touched! He ran it in. A big hole opened up on the right side. Wiley, Ryder, Remmers on there. And the Chiefs have three touchdowns in as many drives to lead 20-9.
Chiefs radio. And it was like that fast. It went from a blowout to a blowout in a second. And yes, we can get into a debate as to whether or not the Bills should have kicked a field goal at the end of the first half to make it 21-12 instead of going for a TD. And whether you can really expect to beat Patrick Mahomes with field goals. We could have that conversation, but come on, let's be real. The way Kansas City was playing last night, it wasn't going to matter. And that was with Mahomes on a jacked up foot and a couple of days out of concussion protocol, and it still didn't matter. He's that good. Kansas City's that good. You see how they played over the course of the season, and they weren't blowing people out. They weren't dominating. Hell, they weren't even covering the spread most of the time. They were just doing their job. They were just winning. Hate to go to another horse racing analogy, but it's almost like they were always the dominant horse in the field. And once they had done enough to win, they had a jockey who wrapped up on the horse, wins, geared down, and saves that horse for another day. That was the Chiefs. But when it's time to actually put the hammer down, like last night, they still have that gear. And they still can dominate flat out. And then look the hell out. Because they will hit you with plays like this.
Going to throw a slant, caught, 35-yard line, juke move, Tyreek Hill, 45, 50-yard line, cuts it back, look out, 40, 35, 30, Cheetah, at full speed, 10, to the 5-yard line. You play and press, the Cheetah will run you all the way around the earth. It's a 71-yard pass play to the Cheetah on a quick slant.
Seriously, at this point, I think the Cheetah could beat a Cheetah. I think the Cheetah could beat a Cheetah in a race. Seriously. I don't know that I have ever seen a dude with that kind of acceleration. I mean, like, Hardman's unbelievable. But Tyreek, I don't think I've ever seen a guy go from 0 to 60 in less than a second. I've never seen a guy accelerate like that. Ever. And obviously, I've been watching this guy for a long time, but he is just amazing. That Cheetah could beat a Cheetah. Then you got Kansas City's offense, right? They start the game 3-and-out, followed by a, quote, muffed punt. Here's what they did after that muff. Touchdown, touchdown, touchdown. Kneel down to end the half. Field goal, touchdown, touchdown. It's just stupid. And they did it against a really good Bills team. A Bills team that came into the game having won 8 straight, including 7 by double digits. A Bills team that would not have been out of place in the Super Bowl. And they just got smoked by KC, flattened by that KC offense. And when you focus too much on the offense, you forget about the playmakers they have on defense and how tough they made it for Josh Allen. So there's going to be plenty of time over the next couple of weeks to talk about Brady v. Mahomes, TB v. KC, Patrick's toe, how much the loss of Eric Fisher is going to hurt Kansas City. Right now, though, I just want to take a moment and I want to appreciate and try to understand what we're witnessing with Patrick Mahomes. This guy's going back to his second straight Super Bowl. He's been a starter for 3 years, and he's gone to a pair of Super Bowls and was an overtime away from a third. And this one came after he got knocked out of the game the previous week. But as Tyrann Mathieu said, there was no way that he was not going to play in this game, and there was no way that he was not going to win this game.
Just watching him work throughout the week, he was the same old Pat. You know, he's the same teammate, same leader, moving around, trying to extend plays, even in practice. On top of that, he's a gamer. So it doesn't necessarily matter the situation or the circumstances. You know, he tends to rise above all of that.
He tends to, right? And it doesn't, just because he makes it look easy does not mean that it is. Just because he makes this seem normal, remember, it's not. But don't take my word for it. Ask Big Red.
I sit there and I'm an old guy that seen a couple of pretty good quarterbacks, and I just keep going, this guy seems to amaze me a little bit more every game.
I mean, that's a guy who's been around every single day. He's been around him every single day. He's been around Mahomes every single day. That's a guy who's been around great quarterbacks throughout his entire career. And he's still amazed every single day by Patrick Mahomes. The fact that Patrick Mahomes is doing this at 25 is insane. The fact that we're here to watch it is special. The only thing more insane than Tom Brady's career is that one day we may all sit back and talk about how the great Patrick Mahomes blew right by the assumed GOAT when it's all said and done. And don't think that Andy is going to take any of the next 2 weeks to relax or reflect on how great a season they've had. My man, Big Red, he knows there is still work to do.
We got room to get better. I mean, we can improve. We had a couple of things that went a little haywacky today, but we stayed on course and we did a lot of good things. So we did more good things than bad things. But this job's a little bit like being a farmer. The work's never done.
You're the best, Andy. I got to admit, I was watching that game. And in the beginning, when you fell behind 9-0, I thought to myself, dang, things are getting a little haywacky out there.
Went a little haywacky today.
You just know that Andy and Eric Bieniemy are going to prepare his guys for any possible haywacky scenario.
Went a little haywacky today.
And you know how you do that? By treating the gig like you're a farmer. There's always work to be done. So, are you craving some protein after a good workout? You know you are. This time, though, don't make a shake. Don't eat a bar. Grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Why Old Trapper? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and tender, and it's made with real strips of steak in quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire. Old Trapper is a family-owned business. They take their smoked beef extremely seriously, and you can taste it in every single bite. Like, who wants dried, tough beef in a bag? Nobody. Old Trapper, though, is the real deal, and it comes in four amazing flavors. Old Fashioned, Teriyaki, Peppered, Hot and Spicy. So the next time you want a great protein and energy snack that you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper beef jerky. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying that way. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name, because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? He is Kevin Ioli. Kevin, it's good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. How you doing, pal?
Good, good. Great to talk to you, Kevin. Thanks so much. You know, there was so much talk about to UFC 257. Before Saturday, though, you had been saying that the co-main event of Hooker Chandler was going to be incredible. Let me start right there. What were you looking to see from Chandler in that fight?
I saw more than I thought I was going to see, to be honest with you, Jim. You know, Chandler is a guy that he brings it. He's a guy that probably could win fights a lot easier than he normally does because he's got that all-American wrestling background, a physically strong guy. But he kind of says, you know what? I'm going to put the wrestling in the background, and he just gets and goes like guns a-blazing and gets in guys' faces. And a lot of times that really hurts him because he ends up getting hit. And I looked at Dan Hooker in that fight, and I thought, boy, Dan Hooker is the perfect opponent for him if you're trying to beat Michael Chandler, because Hooker, those kind of guys, he's perfect against. And I looked at Hooker as having the better striking of the two. But, you know, Hooker did not react very well, I didn't think. You know, Chandler pressured him right from the get-go, and it was almost like Hooker was surprised by that. And I talked to Dan during the week, and he had said, you know, he expected Mike to fight that way. But when the fight actually began and the pressure was coming, Dan looked like he wasn't ready for it. So I was really surprised. But a huge win for Michael Chandler.
We're talking to Kevin Ioli. You know, Kevin, I couldn't wait to see Chandler make his UFC debut. I had really high expectations, and he just smashed him. I mean, I thought he was absolutely electric. I knew he would be, but I thought he was even better than I expected. You made the point that when he signed with the UFC, it was different than when other guys came over from Bellator. What do you mean by that, and how significant was it?
Well, you know, a lot of times, you know, they signed Lyman Good, they signed Will Brooks. You know, when they signed Will Brooks had beaten Chandler and was the Bellator lightweight champion, but there was nobody that felt like Will Brooks was going to go into the UFC top five and start beating those guys. Chandler was a guy that people thought right off the bat, immediately, that he was going to be a contender in the UFC. And so that was the difference. I mean, this was a guy that they got who was in the prime of his career, who had the ability to compete with the Conor McGregors and the Dustin Poiriers and the Charles Oliveiras and Tony Fergusons. And that's what they got. And he showed, you know, Dan Hooker is in that category too. And Chandler went out there and wiped him out. So I think, you know, they went out there and they got a free agent that is the high-end guy that's rarely out there for them. And they showed it was a good investment.
We were talking to Kevin Ioli. So, Kevin, what did you make of Chandler in the post-fight? And then what is next for him?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It depends on if you take, Jim, what Dana White wants or what Dustin Poirier wants. You know, Dana White said at the post-fight news conference, and I think it makes sense, Chandler would be next for Poirier, that would be the fight. Poirier said, I don't want to fight Chandler. And his rationale for that was, I fought all these times in the UFC against the toughest guys in the world. And he fought Max Holloway twice, Eddie Alvarez twice, Justin Gaethje, Conor McGregor twice, you know, on and on and on of tough guys that he fought. And he said, I don't see why Mike Chandler should come into the UFC, fight one fight, and get a championship shot. So I don't want to fight him. And so basically he said he would fight McGregor again in a rematch or fight Charles Oliveira. So that's an interesting thing. Now, does Dana fight with him and try to push him to fight Chandler? I don't think Dana will do that. So I think Chandler, you know, is now going to be in a different spot. So I think where Chandler goes is going to kind of depend on A, when McGregor wants to come back, and B, if they can get Nate Diaz to fight McGregor. So under what I think the UFC would think would be the best case scenario, A, they would go with a rematch between Dustin and Conor. But if that doesn't fail, then they could go Conor versus Nate, Dustin versus Charles, and then have Justin Gaethje sitting there to fight Mike Chandler, which would be another crazy sick fight.
Oh, that'd be unbelievable. Ton of options. Lots of options there across the board. Kevin Ioli is joining us. You know, obviously, I want to start firing questions to you about Conor McGregor, but you got to give Dustin Poirier his due, and I want to start right there. We knew, Kevin, that he was going to be a different fighter now than he was back 6 years ago when he fought Conor McGregor. That was a given. He's had so many wins. He's so much more mature. But what did you make of seeing what transpired in that first round and the patience that he showed, and then in the way that he finished Conor McGregor in the second round?
Yeah, you know, I was so impressed with Dustin, but that was the way I thought Dustin would fight this fight. And the thing was, you know, he made the comment at the post-fight, Jim. He said that Conor hit me with a left hand in the first round, and it was kind of like a flash KO. He said, I was out, but I was backed up against the cage, and he was in front of me. And he said, Conor didn't realize how much he had hurt me. He said, if he had followed up on it, he would have probably finished him. But that was the thing about Dustin, you know, the experience of being able to, okay, you're hurt, but you're still able to think and you're still able to, and he did not show that he was hurt and he was able to survive that storm. That's part of the growth of a fighter, that was there. And I knew, and I said, you know, he was going to have to try to slow that first round down. You know, he just couldn't go out there and, you know, stand toe to toe and, you know, do what Chandler did with Conor, because that's suicide there. And you saw he took Conor down. He was kicking Conor, and that strategy was brilliant. You know, doing what Volkanovski did to Max Holloway, taking the legs out from under Conor. And, you know, hey, if you can't push off to throw your strikes, that limits a big weapon that Conor McGregor has. And those kicks are brutal. And he really hurt him with the kicks, and I think that set up what happened later in the fight.
Right, he chopped him down. Those were unbelievably brutal kicks. So after the fight, Kevin, Conor tried to chalk up the loss due to, quote, inactivity. What do you make of that explanation?
Well, you know, I buy it to like maybe 10% level. You know, I mean, Conor, you know, before the fight, he was talking about his time in Portugal and, you know, a 10-week training camp, and you can't have it both ways. And he looked great. He fought a good first round. You know, he won the first round on pretty much everybody's card. I don't think any public, you know, thought Dustin won that first round. You know, so I thought he looked good. He looked like we expected Conor McGregor to look. So I don't really say it's inactivity. I think he'd have been better had he been active, but his timing was good. That's the thing that you normally lose when you don't fight, is timing. But his timing was good. He was connecting with Dustin. So, you know, I think it was more, you know, Dustin had grown more. And here's the difference. Not that Conor isn't a good fighter anymore. Conor is still an elite fighter. But before, he was the quickest guy in the division and had the fastest hands in the division. And maybe he's dropped half a notch. And that just brings him back into the pack. And I equate it to like golf a couple of years ago when Tiger Woods first came out, and he was driving the ball 30, 40 yards past all the other guys. They realized, hey, this guy's fit. This guy, you know, can move his body the way we can't. They went into the gym. They started working. Fitness became part of their routine, and they started driving it past him, and they were able to compete with him. And I think what happened is Conor has now come down. Other guys have gotten better. They realized he was the standard. They worked to hit the standard he was at. And now the gap that existed between him and other guys isn't there anymore. They're more even, and I think it makes for some really compelling fights.
Kevin Ioli is my guest. All right, Kevin, so to that point, the other fighters have closed the distance between Conor and themselves inside the cage. Then there's the issue of what's going on with Conor outside of the cage. For instance, you wrote, quote, he's worth around $250 million or more due entirely to his ability to beat people up while regaling them with one-liners before he does it. He has everything he could want in life except for the one important thing, peace, end of quote. How much do you think he desires peace, and could you see him walking away from the sport as a result of that desire?
You know, like, it's always dangerous to play amateur psychologist, and that's kind of what I was doing there. But, you know, like, I know Conor fairly well and for a number of years now, and you look at it, Jim, and his life is so crazy. And, you know, I made the point, it's like, you know, he has a Secret Service detail out when he goes to the grocery store, right? He can't go anywhere without 50 people with him. And it's just such, you know, a drain on you mentally. And I think, you know, he would love to have that, you know, where, you know, he would love it. So if he was popular when he was fighting and he was anonymous when he was not, but that's not how life works. And, you know, with social media, you're out there like that. And I just think that, you know, there's a part of Conor McGregor that says, I'd rather have the normal life than what I have now. I've made so much money. I've been so successful. He has that whiskey business that's doing well. And people don't talk about his clothing business, but his clothing business is doing really well. So Conor is in a great position with the amount of money that he has, with the business that he has, that I think, you know, he's going to look long and hard at that and say, do I want to go through the life of a fighter? Because it's not a fun life for a lot of time. You know, these guys love to fight, but they don't necessarily love to do all the grind work that it takes to get ready to fight.
All right, so Kevin, one last thought. Do you think that there's anything that took place on Saturday night that would encourage Khabib to end his retirement?
No. And I said that, you know, when he retired, I didn't think he'd come back. And I just don't think Khabib looks at Conor as his peers. And I think, you know, he looks and says, you know what, they're not in my class. And I think he's right. I think Khabib is just, you know, on a, you know, a whole other level from everybody else out there. And, you know, he's that kind of guy. He made a commitment to his family. He was going to retire. He's kept that commitment, and I think he'll continue. So I don't think we'll see Khabib back. Even though Dana's been putting a lot of pressure on him, you know, Khabib has been resisting, and Dana said at the post-fight that it doesn't look good now for Khabib to come back. And I agree with that. I don't think we will see him back.
Kevin Ioli covers boxing and MMA for Yahoo Sports. Good friend of the program as well. Kevin, thank you so much. Great job as always. And always good to have you here in the jungle.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it, bud.
I want to talk a little bit about Conor McGregor and what went down over the weekend. Like, you've got those two NFL games yesterday, so it feels like Dustin Poirier and Conor McGregor was 3 months ago instead of 3 days ago. Not even 3 days ago. Like, time is so weird now. Time is so funny. It's Monday morning. Conor McGregor was knocked out and turned into a meme on Saturday night, and it already feels like ancient history. Like, we've already had a full cycle of memes of McGregor napping it out on the canvas of that cage. Within a second, that overhead shot of McGregor on the ground, eyes closed, with his arms folded under his head, was all over Twitter with every single caption imaginable. You know, and on some level, it was kind of shocking. Shocking in the sense that it feels like it was so long ago. And on some level, shocking that it happened in the first place. It wasn't last night, but the night before that, Michael Chandler finished Dan Hooker, backflipped off the cage, and then dropped this post-fight interview.
I gotta get something off my chest. I tell y'all this, this is the greatest moment in my professional life. Conor McGregor! Surprise, surprise! There's a new king in the lightweight division, Dustin Poirier. Your time is coming, and Khabib, if you ever do see fit to grace us with your presence back here in the UFC Octagon in your quest for 30, you know you gotta beat somebody. So beat me if you can. God bless. See you at the top.
Man, that's how you announce yourself, right? That's how you handle a UFC debut. And you talk about not just living up to the hype, but smashing it. This guy was incredible, both during the fight and after it. Now, speaking of the hype, there was a lot of hype surrounding Conor going into the fight Saturday night. Not only was he an overwhelming favorite, the talk was about what he would do with the rest of the year. How many fights would he have this year after he handled his business against Poirier? It was as if Dustin, who is one of the baddest guys on the planet, was just some speed bump on the road to what Conor would do for the rest of the year. There was talk about what Conor had hoped to do in 2020 after the Cowboy fight. And then people seemed to think that he would just show up in 2021 and do it again and swap out Cowboy for Poirier and then run it back. And I'm not going to say that I didn't have some of that in the back of my mind, too. In fact, I'm not going to say that I didn't have some of that in the front of my mind. I said it myself, didn't I? On Friday, I hit this guy hard. I really thought that he would put on a show. Now, having said that, I had profound respect for Dustin Poirier. I knew how dangerous he was, and I said as much. But I thought that Conor was of right mind. I thought he was in great shape. I thought he'd put on a show. Except many, many, many thought that it was a foregone conclusion. Then not only would he win, that was not the question, but how would he win? How quickly would it happen? Would it be inside of a minute? Would it be a knockout? Would it be something else? And the answer is none of the above. That wasn't happening with Poirier. That was never going to happen with him. You weren't beating him in a matter of seconds Saturday night. It might have happened the first time, but that was not going to happen again. This guy was way too big of an underdog, given how good he is, how tough he is, how proud he is, how skilled he is, how motivated he is, how much better he is now than he was then. In other words, sleep on this guy and you probably go to sleep. Ask Conor. The thinking going into the fight was that Dustin's chance to win, his best chance to win, was to make it a long fight. Dana White and I talked about that last week. To drag Conor out into the deep waters of the later rounds, tire him out, and then finish him. Except that wasn't his strategy. Instead, it was to absolutely shred Conor's lead leg with calf kicks until Conor was shaky and damaged, and then you finish him off with headshots. It didn't even matter that Conor won the first round, and he did on every scorecard. Dustin was willing to eat a few punches early on. He survived the shoulder strikes that Conor recently added to his arsenal. He made a plan. He continued to work that plan. And then in the second round, he finished him off with kicks to the calf, followed by a left and then a right.
Oh, that leg's beat up, man. Dustin Poirier.
Oh, big left from Poirier. Now a right hand.
Oh, it's hurt.
He's got to go back to the calf. Oh, big left and now a right.
Hurt, man.
Oh. As he comes over and greets his wife, Jolie. Oh. A stunner on Fight Island as they attend to Conor. Dustin Poirier has produced the biggest win of his career by a mile.
Boy, Dustin Poirier beat up the legs. And then you saw him get more and more confident as the fight went on.
Unbelievable.
He landed the left hand, and it was that right hand that he kept missing barely on that he got Conor with.
Man, those leg kicks were unbelievable. You know, sometimes when you hear announcers and they just lose their mind and it's not nearly as good as they make it sound, that was that exciting. That really was that dramatic. And that was that professional. That was professional as hell by Poirier. Brutal, too. Do not sleep on this. That was the first time anybody put Conor to sleep. That was the first time he lost by KO or TKO in his career. It was Dustin Poirier who did that. The guy who lost to Conor back in 2014 came back and he avenged that loss in 2021. But again, honestly, this is not the same guy. He would be the first to tell you that. He's not the same fighter that he was then. He's different. The real question then, is Conor McGregor the same fighter he used to be? Or have we already seen the best of Conor? And are we starting to see the beginning of the end? Or just the flat-out end? He said afterwards that he is looking to fight again. But as always, when you've got an enormous pile of cash, getting punched in the face and knocked out does not seem like a whole hell of a lot of fun when you've got millions and millions and millions already stacked. But on the other hand, being Dustin Poirier right about now seems like it is a hell of a lot of fun. And he's enjoying it. It's not just that he won. It's how he won and then how he handled that win. He didn't freak out. He didn't act like he was shocked because he wasn't shocked.
Yeah, I'm happy, man, but I'm not surprised. I put in the work. First off, I want to say Conor took this result very professionally over here. He's a pro, man, and nothing but respect. We're 1-1. Maybe we have to do it again. Yeah, the goal was to be technical and to pick my shots, not brawl at all. You know, I have a big tendency, and you saw in the end of this one, I had him hurt, so I went a little crazy. But I can box, I can kickbox very technically, but I have a tendency of just getting crazy and trying to hurt guys and getting very out of position and getting myself in trouble that I shouldn't be. I think I showed a little bit of counterboxing here. I know Max Holloway thinks he has the best boxing, but I got 2 wins over the kid. Nothing but respect to him. I'm a big fan, but I beat him twice, and I felt like I was boxing pretty well with Connor. He hit me with some good counter twos. We knew his timing on the counter two was some of the best in the game, but I just don't give a man. I'm here to win. I felt like this was a title fight. If Khabib's not coming back, me and Connor, the two best guys, I think this is a title fight. I'm the champion.
I really like the way he handled himself. Didn't lose his mind. Not overly emotional. Man, that was business. And business is really good for Dustin Poirier right now. Check these numbers out quickly. He's 11-2 since that first loss to Connor. One of the losses was to Khabib. The wins include Anthony Pettis, Max Holloway, Eddie Alvarez, Justin Gaethje, Dan Hooker, and now Conor McGregor. That's a legendary run, and he deserves respect. He's earned it. He's earned a ton of it. So don't ever overlook this guy ever again, or you're going to end up on the floor napping it out and getting memed into oblivion. That was an unbelievable finish. Great performance. So where does that leave him? Where does that leave Conor? I tweeted after the fact that Khabib, like, haven't you seen enough? Between Chandler and Poirier, haven't you seen enough? Don't you want to come back? Isn't that what you needed to see? But then not long thereafter, Dana White was saying, yeah, it doesn't sound like he's going to come back. 1-800-636-8686. You got to put the proper respect on Dustin Poirier. I mean, I would argue that even before that win, arguably he was a Hall of Famer. Arguably. But after a performance like that, man, you have to put respect on this guy. Have to. Extremely professional. And it goes back to what I always say about UFC and why I love it so much. Anything can happen and does, and everybody can be beaten. I mean, Conor had already been beaten, but you never know. You just never know in that game, in that sport, in that company. That's why it's so dramatic. Member of the Buffalo Bills Mafia, he is Mark Stein. Mark, what's going on? How are you?
I'm good, sir. I'm good.
No, I think I know what you mean. I think I know exactly what you mean by a response like that, so let me rephrase the question. Before we talk basketball, let me ask you, as a Bills fan, how are you feeling today, Mark?
I'm not shocked. I think realistically everybody knew the Chiefs were a big favorite in that game. And look, if I'm being as candid as I can, I lived in the Buffalo area basically from ages 2 to 9. All my sporting allegiances were formed then, but I am in truth a much bigger Sabres fan than a Bills fan. And it's really my 14-year-old son, Aaron, who brought me back to the Bills this year because he on his own, without me even pushing him, loves Josh Allen, became a Bills fan. So this season in our house, every Sunday the Bills were on, and it was the first time really in my fatherhood that it was like that. So I definitely got back into it this year. But like I said, I am no NFL expert, so let's not waste too much time. But with the state of the Bills' defense and a lack of a running game, you're not going to beat the Chiefs to get to the Super Bowl. So they got Josh Allen, they got Diggs, they got some great players, but there are still holes to fill before they can be a legit Super Bowl contender.
Hey, listen, I appreciate that, but my biggest takeaway and the best part about that is that you and your son can share that. That's a great thing. We know this about fathers and sons in sports and passing that on, so I think that's really cool. Listen, thing is, tomorrow is the one-year anniversary of the passing of Kobe Bryant, and I want to get into your piece about Kobe and Zach Randolph in a moment, but overall, when you think about the passing of Kobe, what kind of thoughts come to mind?
I think I'm like everyone, and I know you had a relationship with him, and I think we're all fans, media, whatever, you know, it still is incomprehensible. It is just still impossible to believe. I've had this conversation with so many colleagues. We write these stories. I've lost count by now how many kind of retrospective tribute, insidery kind of pieces, kind of telling various aspects of Kobe's story, and after writing them, it still just does not sink in. It just still does not seem possible. It's the saddest story I've ever covered in my 35 years doing this, and I have a feeling it's it's going to always be the saddest story that I ever covered. It's just not just for what Kobe meant to people within sports and beyond sports, but you know, there were three teenage girls on that helicopter, and just lives cut so tragically short. And I think what just sticks for me is Kobe was 17 when I met him. I was the Lakers beat writer for the LA Daily News, so he was 17 at the first press conference that I covered with him when he was introduced as a Laker, and you know, his daughter was with him, and you know, these are teenagers on that helicopter. Alyssa Altobelli, Peyton Chester, you know, they're teenagers too, and I just that's the part that I can't let go of.
Right. Mark Stein is joining us. So, Mark, Zach Randolph moved to Southern California after he retired, and his daughter joined Team Mamba. What was Zach's impression of Kobe when they played in the league?
Yeah, you know, look, they were contemporaries. Randolph was drafted in 2001, so Kobe was in the league for 5 years by that point. But, you know, Zach worked his way to all-star status. They played in a couple all-star games together, so they were, you know, rivals, but it was really nothing more than a mutual respect of, you know, guys who cross paths a lot on the court. And, you know, I think people were aware after everything happened last January that Zach Randolph's daughter was on the team, on the team Kobe coached. But Zach and his daughter, they really haven't talked much about this, and you can understand it. I mean, the grief for everyone really involved in this, so close to it, just it must be unbearable, and there are a lot of stories about, I mean, this thing shattered five families. I mean, this crash, it's got to be impossible to talk about for the people whose families were directly involved. But I approached Zach recently to see if he would be willing to discuss it, because he just had this unique perspective going from an all-star competing against Kobe for years to now Kobe is coaching his daughter. They, you know, you never, I mean, Zach himself said it, never could have imagined that he and Kobe Bryant would form this coach-parent partnership. But Zach Randolph just speaks of, he says Kobe's the best to ever do it. He's not talking about the player. He's talking about the coach. He was that moved by how much Kobe put into coaching that team. And, you know, Kobe did. I mean, I think maybe the most telling line in the piece is, you know, Zach Randolph said, Kobe ran this like a real organization. That's how seriously he took it for these girls. And I mean, they practiced 5 days a week, and just all the strength training and beach workouts and all these things that Kobe brought to this group. And I mean, he was, I think we all know, I think we've seen enough footage. And I mean, this coaching his daughter and coaching that team meant so much to him.
We're talking to Mark Stein. Mark, there is a great quote in the piece when Randolph told you that Kobe, quote, loved my baby. He told me, I love her, man. When he told me that, I told him, we're brothers for life, end of quote. What does that say then about both men?
Yeah, you're right. That's the most powerful line in the story, probably. Just I don't think Zach Randolph was expecting that. Again, he knew Kobe Bryant from competing against him for years, but competing against somebody, it's a much different thing when, I mean, you know, all of us who have kids and they play sports, you know, that relationship with the coach, it's important. It's a big deal, because the kids are spending so much time on these traveling teams. And I think a lot of parents can just identify with you want to feel good about the coach that you're sending your kids to. And, you know, Zach Randolph felt more than good about it. I mean, he just, you know, Kobe told him, just, you watch how good she's going to be when I'm done working with her. And so, you know, it's the tragedy of this. It's all coming back for everyone now. It's going to be a very emotional week. You know, the 1 year anniversary is tomorrow, and I still just can't believe it.
It's a nearly impossible thing to get your head around, for sure. Mark Stein joining us, and I hate to keep belaboring it, but there's so many interesting aspects, and it's so sad. It is so, so sad, and it's all coming back again. But there's another relationship I do want to ask you about, and that's the one between Pau Gasol and Kobe's family, which to me really is fascinating. Now, it's not if you know anything about Pau, because he's such an amazing guy and a tremendous guy. But from what you've seen of that, what does that tell you about Pau as a person that maybe something you didn't even know?
Yeah, you know, my former colleague, Ramona Shelburne, she did a wonderful piece on Pau and just how hard he's tried to kind of be there for the family as much as you can. I mean, there's, you know, it can never be enough, but, you know, he's trying to provide as much support as possible. And just, I think it's interesting that, you know, as reporters, we so much covered what Pau could do for Kobe's championship window, but also Kobe, you know, kind of toughening Pau up to win a championship. But I found it very interesting that Pau, you know, spoke about in this piece trying to coach Kobe the other way, that, you know, it's okay to let your guard down and show love and let some of those vulnerabilities out. And, you know, Pau is probably the only one who could have done that because they, you know, won so much together, and it was, you know, such a game changer for Kobe after that trade and you know, having a player of that level join him again and giving him the chance to win two more championships. So, I mean, look, I think you've encountered Pau yourself. You know, I mean, there aren't many kinder people in sports or the world really than Pau. I mean, he just is an incredibly kind person, and they were a duo of opposites, but I think everybody sees now how close they really were.
No, I think you're right. Pau's a really different type. I mean, like a world-class athlete, but, I mean, so kind and just such a good guy. And I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, Mark, let me just really quickly ask you, and there's not a convenient pivot here, but when you look at the Lakers really quickly, you look at LeBron and he's averaging 32.4 minutes per game, which would be the lowest of his career by quite a bit. They're tied with the Clippers for the best record in basketball. So how pleased do you think the Lakers are with their strategy and how it's working out so far? And then what's that say about their depth?
They're in a class by themselves. And that's, you know, in their journey, you know, last season there were so many, even after the Anthony Davis trade, there were so many doubts. Are they even the best team in L.A.? I mean, that was a legitimate discussion all season long. And the reality was, I think from the analyst chair, we all said the Clippers had the higher ceiling. The Clippers had more depth. The Clippers, had a more talented cast around their two stars. And, you know, there were so many questions about that Laker team. And now they conquered the bubble. And this season, yeah, there are a lot of new pieces that they're still finding their way, and you know, I don't think it's by any means seamless. But when you talk to people around the league, I think most teams, most rival front offices would paint it the same way for you. The Lakers are in a class by themselves, and everybody else is trying to get to that level. I mean, they are clear favorites, and they were not in year one of LeBron and Anthony Davis.
I agree with you. He covers the NBA for the New York Times. He is a Cal State Fullerton and a Big West Conference legend. Do not forget either of those things. He is the man behind the New York Times NBA newsletter. I want to reiterate, he won the 2019 Kurt Gowdy Media Award, or was a recipient thereof. He is Mark Stein. Mark, appreciate you very much, as always. Thanks for coming back.
Good to be with you, sir. Be good.
Good night now!